I have a particular type of excitement, Hebrew we say hitragshut. There isn't any really accurate English translation for it. Excited and nervous, somehow are not quite either. Neither does it. But there's a special feeling tonight as we conclude a 6-part series that actually took us 7 weeks because we were interrupted with Hanukkah in the middle. But I want to, and of course, as we wrote on the blurb, right? There's no way we could title the course "Highlights of the Talmudic Portrait Gallery" and not end with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, or not spend at least an evening with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, trying to capture some on a tip of the iceberg in an hour and 15 minutes, something of this part, of the magnitude and the stature and the nature of this particular man who unquestionably left his mark on rabbinic Judaism and Judaism as we know it today in ways that are obvious even at first glance. But I want to start first with an observation or with a thought that is also an introduction to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, but also in ways the beginning are concluding what we've been doing over the past 7 weeks, right, 6 classes. And I want to just remind you, or I want to articulate again what I think we've been seeing very consistently throughout almost every personality that we spent an evening with. What we saw was how time and again, through rabbinic narratives, we have descriptions of these great individuals whose greatness varies from one to each other. Each one has their own particular greatness, right? Their own particular characteristic, their own particular quality, which I think we can tease out of the stories and perceive as we read their stories. Right? So we have one whose greatness is his unbound and unlimited creativity, or just this unlimited creative impulse that just works and works and works and works. And we have another rabbinic figure whose greatness is in his zeal for preserving Torah as being absolutely divine, of standing guard against Torah being anything but divine. For Torah to become human is to him an unbearable idea. So that was Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkin, and his greatness lies in the passion that he has for that particular angle or that particular perspective. We saw Rabbi Akiva, whose greatness lies in his ability to perceive truths that lie behind the literal, right? His mastery of Midrash, both in terms of text and in terms of historical reality. He is the one who can pierce, right, the here and now, penetrate the simple, literal, obvious events or words of the text and allow us, right, to see and to perceive new and ever revealing truths of the Torah. That was a greatness that Rabbi Akiva offered us. Right? Just last week we saw Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who maybe perhaps represents a different kind of greatness, the greatness of that drive to retreat from the physical world, to remove oneself from the physical world, to totally immerse oneself in the spiritual and intellectual pursuit of Torah, and to personify that type of greatness and to achieve, right, through that passionate dedication to a particular ideal or a particular idea, to reach heights of achievement. Here's what I want to emphasize, that time and again, what we saw the rabbinic narrative doing regarding each one of these individuals with their own particular characteristic and their own particular greatness was emphasizing how great those achievements really were, right? That we confirm time and again that each one of these individuals reached levels of intensity and levels of achievement, each in their own way or each in their own field, that could not have been achieved had they not been as committed and as passionate to their truth as they actually were. And yet what we also saw time and again, and that was confirmed story after story after story, whether it was voices from heaven coming out and saying, "Hen hen ma'aseh merkava," or truths that were accessed by these men who, presumably, the narrative seemed to be implying, could not have been accessed in any other way. But just as strongly, what we saw continuously through, I think, time after time, personality after personality, was that each of these great men, the narrator seemed to suggest, and more than suggest, that their greatness was their strongest greatness was also their strongest flaw. And that the greatness, right, and each time and again, each individual time and again, we saw that it was particularly their strength that was also their greatest weakness. Their flaws, their failures, even if we are to even to go that far, had their origins in the same characteristic, in the same traits, in the same impulse that made them great. It was that same impulse that also produced their greatest flaws. And as we tell their stories, that becomes apparent time and again. All of that is by way of introduction, by way of summary and conclusion, but also by way of introduction to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Because when we talk about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, as we will very, very quickly see, we are perhaps talking about the greatest of the greats. We're talking about a man whose arrival on the scene of Jewish history, of rabbinic history, is perceived as ending an era. And that his accomplishments, his producing this work that is referred to as the Mishnah, is perceived almost in real time. Right? At least that's how it's narrated into rabbinic legend. Almost in real time, it's perceived that an era has now come to an end, and a new era has to begin. That after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, there's no continuing, right, in the same way or in the same mode. Something significant has happened, and there are moments like that in intellectual history or in the history of cultures, the history of human enterprises, that there's a sense that something so dramatic has taken place that something critically different has to, our response is we're now in a new era. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's arrival, or Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's story, is such that the magnitude and the proportion of his effect on the rabbinic world is such that almost immediately it's perceived that we're now beginning a new era. And indeed, the Tannaitic era comes to an end. The Amoraitic era, right, I don't know how long it takes before someone gives it a name, but very soon it feels like, right, we are now in a new era, the era in which the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's Mishnah is now the focus of attention, is the focus of study, and the rest is almost commentary to it, right? The Talmud, both Talmuds, the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi, will present themselves as being footnotes to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's Mishnah, commentary to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's Mishnah. So this man is huge, right? If we were using the image of the portrait gallery, he certainly has a gallery to himself, right? He has a wall to himself, if not a whole gallery to himself, the size of this man. So much so that, as many of you know, in many of our rabbinic texts, he will be referred to as simply Rebbe. Okay? Rabbi, there's no need to name him by name, because if we speak about the rabbi, right, the rabbi is this rabbi, is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. In some texts, he's also referred to as Rabbeinu HaKadosh, right? Which is again an indication of the position that he has, right, in this rabbinic kind of rabbinic collective, that the mark that he's left, the impact that he's had on this world and the way they speak about him. So if he's the greatest of the greats, then the phenomena that we were talking about before, where someone's greatness is sometimes precisely their weakness, and each one of these rabbinic stories ends up demonstrating that, yes, a particular passion, a particular commitment, a particular idea leads one to great achievements, but can also sometimes be the very thing that you have to learn, right, to retreat from sometimes, or for it to be successful, we have to observe that it's not necessarily, right, in its extreme form, it is not adaptable or adoptable. What happens to Rebbe? What happens to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? The story of the ultimate great, okay, the ultimate rabbi, where does he go? Or where do we go with him? And that's, the introduction, my introduction. And in a moment, we're going to turn to the text, which, of course, are much more interesting than what I have to say. We'll let the text speak for themselves, and we'll let some of the text, we'll let the texts sort of reveal, through our reading of them, how Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's story, or part of his story, obviously, how his story maybe perhaps is told through some of these rabbinic texts, and what perhaps can we walk away with understanding about the way his character has left its imprint on the rabbinic collective narrative, okay, the rabbinic collective story. Okay, so here's our first introduction. I want to start with text number one. is maybe perhaps a decisive moment in rabbinic literature where someone is going to tell us something about Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, is going to coin a phrase that's going to be continuously on our minds this evening. Someone is going to describe Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in a description that is going to both emphasize his uniqueness. In what way is he different than anyone else that's came before him, and to give us a glimpse into what place and position does he occupy in the rabbinic imagination that perhaps, or not perhaps, that no one else does. Okay, now, the fact is, however, before we can read this text, I need to give you a little bit of context about where this text is presented, or what is the context in which this text was first introduced. It's important to, I think, fully appreciate the actual statement that's being said. So it's from Sanhedrin, as you can see. And I need to bring you a little bit into the context of the Masechet and what's being discussed at this particular moment when this statement will be introduced. We're talking in general about, Sanhedrin in general talks about the judicial system, the court system, how it works, the Jewish court system, obviously, rabbinic court system, how it works. One of the things that we're being told here, or that the Mishnah has just told us in the context of which this observation is going to be made in a moment, has to do with drawing distinctions between different types of court procedures that are appropriate for different types of court matters, right? And primarily is distinguishing between monetary matters and hearings on monetary issues as opposed to hearings on a court procedure that has to do with offenses that potentially could be capital crimes for which someone could potentially be sentenced to death. And one of the differences that the Mishnah talks about between hearing monetary cases and hearing capital crimes has to do with when the judges begin to deliberate over, after hearing the testimony, and the judges begin to deliberate over the case itself, there are different instructions given that in the following way. In monetary cases, let's start with capital cases. In capital cases, the Mishnah says, we always... I'm going to go back again. I'm going to start with the monetary. Sorry, I apologize. The English is throwing me. It's the monetary cases. We always start from the gadol. That's what the Mishnah says. B'dinei mamonot matchilim min hagadol. Alright? In other words, the senior judge speaks first. The senior judge will always express his opinion first on the deliberations as the deliberations begin. Whereas in capital cases, the Mishnah says, we start from the tzad, we start from the side benches, from the side seats. The implication is, of course, that we sit in descending order of seniority, or the judges sit in descending order of seniority. So starting from the side benches is a way of saying we start from the junior judges. Right? So we have a very different court procedure if it's monetary cases or capital punishment. If it's capital punishment, we start from the junior judges. They speak first. We start, if in monetary cases, we go straight to the senior judge, right? Now, if we play around for a minute with our own minds, again, all this before we actually get to the Talmud's observation on this, we had to ask ourselves, well, what's the logic, what's the rationale behind starting with the gadol as opposed to starting with the katan, right, starting from the side benches? So I think we can pretty easily think of what the explanations might be. Why does it make sense to start from the senior judge? What would be working for this arrangement?
It influences everybody.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's probably a bad thing by today's standards, but he knows the most. He's the oldest.
Okay, so let's put it as an advantage. So what's the advantage of starting with the? What's the advantage of starting with the senior judge?
It's faster.
Okay, it's first of all a much more efficient. Presumably, assuming for a moment, if he's the senior judge, he has more experience. He has more. It's more efficient. Go straight to the point. We don't have to hear all of the beginner judges, all the junior judges with a lot of talk. Let's go straight to the point. Probably, or oftentimes, many of the younger judges will just agree. It'll just be a lot more efficient. And efficiency is, of course, something that a court system is interested in. It's not something that we should dismiss by any means. Efficiency is important. Another reason to start with the gadol.
Because of the gadol's experience and coverage of all the different kinds of monetary damages, the gadol, they would look up to the gadol to provide what is the truth in or the essence, as opposed to a capital crime, the issue of emotions and ethics, not ethics, but judging someone who might lose their life over a decision, witnesses, etc. It seems that you need more people involved rather than...
Okay. All right, so you're already pushing us over here, so I'm going to go with you. You say the reason to start with the Catan, and it comes back to your comment before, is that there's more freedom, potentially we're facilitating more freedom of expression, more plurality of opinions, nahon? Because of what you said before, indeed, because once the Gadol speaks, it's quite likely, naturally, humanly, will affect others, and if you really want to encourage, because there's so many, such a range of considerations that we want, and because the stakes are so high, we want to make sure that everyone speaks freely. The best way to speak freely is to let the younger ones speak first, and the older ones to speak. But again, if we go back to monetary cases, in monetary cases, we seem to be saying, that might be true, but in these, where the stakes are less high, I'm right now, possibly I'm paying a price of this. I know it consciously, but the value of efficiency here overrules this, right, this principle, whereas in capital punishment, I'm saying it's the reverse, okay? This is more important. I want to have one other thing, though, on the board, on the side of starting with the Gadol, because it's going to be important for us in a moment, and that is, why don't we start with the Gadol?
I wanted to say something different.
Go ahead.
Since she went over to the capital case,
Okay. Is
the, a reason to start with the more junior members is because there's so much at stake here. You're talking about a person's life that I don't think we need to consider efficiency. We can take our time. We should take
our
time because it's just much bigger stakes.
Absolutely.
And therefore, you already said it. What I was going to say is that everybody should be heard.
Okay.
And if you start with the younger ones, then they won't be influenced by the
Gadol.
And so everybody will actually say what they think.
Okay, excellent. Okay. One other concept I'm just missing, I want it on the board, for another reason to start with the Gadol very intuitively. What would maybe perhaps also facilitate or foster this position of starting with the Gadol? It's very intuitive. It might be so trivial that you're not even daring to say it or not daring to think it.
Was there a system of appeals?
Complicated. Let's not go there right now. Okay, more complicated. We're going to study all of Masechet Sanhedrin, or much of Masechet Sanhedrin to fully answer that. I want to say one simple thing, and that is there's a value of...
Kavod,
bidiyuk, that's what I want to say. It's trivial, but respect, okay? Respect does seem to require. Now, this is not a value that we can say is not integrated within rabbinic thinking. I mean, the rabbinic thinking does require one to treat one's elders, certainly one's senior, that is, to give the senior judge the right to begin, would seem to be within rabbinic etiquette, within rabbinic protocol, it would seem to be the proper thing to do. I mean, a younger judge would not speak before an older judge. It seems to be, if we're going to do that, once again, in capital crime, we'll say, it's so important to me that everybody speak that I'm willing to forego even my values of respect and proper behavior, that a younger person should not speak in the presence of an older, certainly not speak before the elder has spoken. And in Dinei Mamonot, I'm saying, because of the nature of what we're discussing, I'm adhering to these two values. In Dinei Nefashot, I'm saying, no, this is something more important going on here, and here this overrules everything else. Okay, now all of that, keeping all of that in mind, let's finally read the text and get to a statement that has to do with Rabbi. In the context of the Mishnah that just taught us that law, taught us that policy, taught us that practice, the Talmud tells us the following statement. Rav said, Rav is a first-generation Babylonian Amora. He is one of the two great academies of Babel. He establishes Yeshivat Sura, which will exist throughout Talmudic times and well into the Gaonic period. Rav is one of the founding fathers, as it were, of the Babylonian rabbinic community. But he originates from Babel. He does come from a Babylonian Jewish family. But he goes to Eretz Yisrael and studies Torah for a great many years in Eretz Yisrael under the tutelage of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was a student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and actually Talmudic legend and lore, this already begins Talmudic Personalities Part 2, because it would start with Rav. Rav, as a student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, according to Talmudic legend, when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi publishes his Mishnah, Rav takes that Mishnah, goes back to Bavel, establishes the Academy of Surah, and is instrumental in bringing the Mishnah to Bavel, to the yeshivot and academies of Bavel. So Rav is a very important character, and through him, we can hear something about what it was like to be a student of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. And here he goes. Rav said, I was once one of the voters in the court of Rebbe. Okay? I was not only a student of Rebbe, but I was asked to join a court which was headed by Rebbe, and I was presumably, again, one of the junior members in the court of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And he says, and it was with me that the voting began. All right? So he testifies that having sat on the court of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he actually began the deliberations. They began with him. Now, he's certainly not the gadol in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's court. If anything, he's probably the katan. Okay, now, of course, the question that we have remains unanswered is what kind of a case was it that he's testifying about? Now, here we can very easily answer that question with a simple historical fact, is that capital cases are no longer tried. Since the destruction of the temple, the rabbis themselves, the Mishnah, say that there is no longer capital punishment being tried and executed since the destruction of the temple. So if, in the time, if Rav is indeed testifying that he was in the court, they were certainly trying a monetary case. In which case, what Rav is testifying to is that in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's court, they did not implement the policy that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi codified in his own Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi codified that in monetary cases, you start with the gadol, but in his own court, he would start with the katan. And that's picked up by the Talmud, and the Gemara indeed says, but did we not learn we commence with the eldest? Didn't you say that you should have started with the senior judge? You should have started with the gadol? Why did you start with Rav rather than Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi himself? And the Gemara then shares with us the following statement. Rava, the son of Rava. Others say it was Rabbi Hillel, the son of Rabbi Vavas. The voting in the court of Rebbe was different from the usual form, because in all their voting, they began with the side benches. That Rebbe actually instituted in his own court a policy and practice that is not in accordance with what he instructed in the Mishnah. In his own case, he made an exception. And he said, in my court, we're going to start with the younger. Now, the question, of course, is why? And there are a number of possibilities we can suggest. What do we learn about, or why would Rebbe have felt that in his own court, he needs to deviate from the practice and policy that he himself instituted in the Mishnah? So, anyone want to jump in there?
It's so important, he may felt he would overwhelm everyone
else. Okay. One possibility, which I personally actually think is very present here, is Rebbe himself realized that in his case, okay, in ordinary cases, we can suspend the concern of freedom of expression because, yes, we'll pay a price of freedom of expression, that's true, but this right now, efficiency and respect is more important to me, so whatever price we end up paying here, we'll pay it. Rebbe knows that in his case, it's not paying a price of freedom of expression. It's not that we'll have less freedom and less polarity, it's that everybody else will be paralyzed. If Rebbe speaks, if Rebbe's the gadol, he is so authoritative. He is so, looms so large in everyone's mind that if he speaks, there will be no conversation. None at all. Not less conversation than there might have been if the junior members spoke, but no conversation at all. It would be like trying the case with one judge. And that is not a possibility within Jewish law. You need minimally three judges to try a case of dinei mamonot. So Rebbe is so aware of his own overpowering presence and his own authority that he realizes that in his case, he always has to start with the younger judges. He is so overwhelming. Kim?
I don't know if this is true. I'm saying something that I don't know about his personality.
Go ahead.
But if his personality, if he was a humble person, then it would be out of humility. He doesn't want to appear arrogantly.
Mitsuyan.
Wants to...
Okay. Excellent. So those are two possibilities that suggest themselves, I think, almost intuitively. What's interesting to wonder about is, are they mutually exclusive? Intuitively, one of them sounds like he's such an overwhelming person, whereas the other has him being more humble. On the other hand, we can all recognize that if even if we took track one, right, our explanation number one, he's so overpowering. The very fact that he realizes that, and he realizes that he needs to institute a policy, might suggest that maybe he's both. He is, on the one hand, aware of the effect that he has on others. He's aware of the authority that he has. He's aware of the impression that he makes that he has on others, and yet he still has that ability to say, "Well, then I need to hold back, or I need to institute a different policy that will allow people to be able to express themselves freely in my presence." All right. So maybe they're not mutually exclusive, in spite of the fact that intuitively they sound like they're coloring, they're sketching a little bit of a different profile. Okay. And then
just as a little bit of a compliment to that, that someone who is very secure in their position of authority can get rid of the kavod.
Doesn't need the protocol.
If you don't have anything to prove, you know you're securing
your authority. And everyone knows.
And everyone knows it. Okay, I'll let go of some of my kavod. Like,
good, yeah. Thank you. Yes.
The middle position is that he's a superb educator.
He's a
superb educator. He needs to draw out the younger rabbis and hear what they have to say.
Mitzvah. We're going to get back to that hopefully by the very end of today. I'm going to come back to him as a Rebbe, as a teacher, which is, amongst other things, what the concept is. He's a wonderful, he's a master teacher as well. I'm going to come back to that, Kim.
I was just going to say, as a role of a teacher, if he opens it up for other people, if he doesn't, how are they going to learn?
Okay, Mitsuyan. So let's keep that idea also somewhere. Let's move on. I see our time is always working against us. The Talmud now continues and quotes yet another statement by the same author, the same person who told us that in Rebbe's court, they always had to begin with the younger, also tells us the following statement. Rabba, the son of Rabba, another state, it was Rabbi Hillel, the son of Rabbi Vallas, okay, the same debate, also said, from Moses until Rebbe, we do not find Torah and high office combined in one person. I'm going to read it in the original because I want the words of the original to be ringing in your ears. Miyamot Moshe ve'ad Rebbi lo matzinu Torah u'gdula b'makom echad. Okay? Torah and gdula. Those were a hard combination of words to translate into English. Torah, well, I left it Torah, okay? But gdula seems to be implying, in context here, we'll have to see whether this indeed is some kind of non-Torah related status or stature or authority. And from Moshe to Rebbe, listen carefully, from Moshe to Rebbe, there was no other individual who combined these two greatness in these two areas. Torah, greatness in Torah on the one hand, but also greatness in what would appear to be, well, what would Gedula be there?
Political,
military, economic, leadership roles. We do not find this particular combination is a rare historic occurrence. That one individual combines greatness in both areas. He is both unquestionably the master of Torah. No one else competes in any way to his mastery of Torah. But at the same time, he also occupies a position of leadership in other matters, in secular matters, what we ordinarily would refer to maybe perhaps as secular matters, in ways that no one else does in his generation. Now, there are two people so far, at least according to Rabba, the son of Rabba, says there are two people so far in our history who've done that, who've combined all areas of leadership and greatness in one individual, and it's no less than Moshe Rabbeinu,
right.
And then it happened again, only once in Jewish history, at least again up until this point, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Now that's a very exclusive group of people, right, to be isolated as being characterized by, it's Moshe and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. The Gemara, in a section that I actually skipped over, those are the three dots that I put in there to represent that I skipped a spot here, a discussion. The Gemara says, wait a second, Moshe Rabbeinu, and then again, not till Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Now let's consider for a minute who we just skipped over, okay? Who did we skip over?
David
HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, Yoshua,
Ezra
Nehemiah, right? Basically all of our biblical characters, basically from Chumash on, Yirmiyahu, Shmuel HaNavi, so many huge people. Not to mention now, if we transition into Talmudic times, look at all the rabbinic figures we just passed over. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shimon bar, I don't know who else, but the Gemara is astonished by this, and actually begins to examine one by one. But what about Shmuel? What about Shaul HaMelech? What about Shlomo HaMelech? What about David HaMelech? What kept them? Why don't you say that they're also Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad? And each time the Talmud rejects the reason why, or rejects them as candidates for that role, or for that description. And what we begin to see is that slowly the stakes are raised, because what the Gemara says continuously is the requirements for this membership is that you are solely all alone, occupying the places of leadership where no one else is coming close to you. Now, Ezra had Nehemiah, okay? David HaMelech, the Gemara goes through them all. Shmuel HaNavi had Shaul HaMelech. I mean, there are all kinds of things going on. There are all kinds of, they share the leadership role. Whereas these two individuals were not only occupying the place of ultimate leadership and responsibility in all areas of communal life, including spiritual, religious, intellectual, political, military, monetary, financial, everything, they were there alone at the top. No one else came near them in terms of sharing the burdens of responsibilities. That's what Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad. And those are very rare circumstances. It only happens twice. Well, actually, the Gemara continues and says, it happens again a third time. And here we are a couple of generations later, not many, about five or six generations, certainly much less time that has passed since Moshe Rabbeinu to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, where then the postscript to this is Rav Ada Bar Ahava said, from about five generations into the future, I similarly claim that from the days of Rebbe until Rav Ashi, we do not find learning and high office in the same person. He adds one additional individual into this very exclusive club. He says, you know what? It happens again. Happens again a couple of centuries later, with Rav Ashi. Now that we're looking at this trio, Moshe Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and Rav Ashi, the three of them are singled out as being described as Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad. Those three names should ring a bell. Or those three names ring a bell. What do they say to you? What do you hear?
Moshe wrote the Torah. Wow. Rabbi wrote the Mishnah. Rav Ashi, I believe, wrote the redacted the Gemara.
Okay. Rav Ashi is associated with, and here I'm certainly not going to get into trouble with my professors at Hebrew University and say that Rav Ashi redacted the Talmud, but I will say that he is associated in terms of rabbinic with the beginnings of the completion of the Talmud. These three individuals represent the three canonical works of our world of Torah. Torah Shebichtav, right? Certainly, Moshe. And Torah Shebal Peh, the two canonical works of Torah Shebal Peh, Mishnah and Talmud. And these three individuals are associated with those three central canonical works. And now we're saying something very interesting about those three individuals. Our three central texts of the world that makes up the world of Torah were all produced by men about whom we say they contained Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad. What are we emphasizing? What do we want to say? What are we saying? Okay. So that says something about, one way of looking at it, is that this is a statement about our canonical works of Torah. They are all produced not in some ivory tower, not in some world, some self-sealed off world of absolute, right? They are produced by men who not only were giants in Torah, but understood fully the real world. They also occupied leadership positions in this world of Gedula, in this world of government, in this world of communal life. They knew, and that's a characteristic not only of these three men, but it's a characteristic of the works they've produced. These are works that are produced by people who combined Torah and Gedula. So we're saying something about our canonical works. But I see our time is really going by too quickly. We need to pick up speed a little bit. But I want to suggest one last thing before we move on. And that is there might be an observation here as well about not only about our canonical works, but about the process of canonization. And maybe this is a little bit more of a I won't say cynical, but a kind of wide open kind of an observation that possibly what we're being suggested here is, what's being suggested here is, canonical works can only be produced by people who are Torah and Gedula, because it requires to produce a canonical work that will be accepted, whose authority will be accepted. Canonization takes place when the right person is in the right place at the right time. Because for your work to become canonical, presumably you need the resources to make it so, to distribute, all right? To make your words known, to have your words accepted as authoritative, as we all well know, right? Who writes the textbooks? It's not only necessarily, right, the wisest and most learned and most knowledgeable, but it's the people who have the right connections. Video, have connections with the publishing world and maybe with the Board of Education, and whose books are going to be published? Whose books are they going to make it into the curriculum? Whose books are going to be accepted as being the final word on everything? It's not only the people who have Torah. It's the people who have Torah and Gedula, right? And possibly we're beginning to get an indication why Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was able to produce the Mishnah and his work was accepted is not only because he was the most learned and knowledgeable in Torah, but because he had the wherewithal that when he produced his Mishnah, given the power that this man had concentrated, then his Mishnah was received as the Mishnah. And it became indeed the canonized core of Jewish tradition. But it was only because he had that combination of ability, of he was in the right place at the right time with the right set skill set, right, and the right position and resources to be able to make his work, to produce that end result. I'm going to ask you to hold off for a second because I want to move on. We've got a lot more texts, as you can see. Let's read number two. Number two will move in right exactly here. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda says in the name of Rabbi Shimon, beauty and strength and wisdom and riches and old age, and honor, and glory, and children. Right?
Yeah.
That's a pretty impressive list. Beauty, and strength, and wisdom, and riches, and old age, honor, glory, and children are comely to the righteous, and comely to the world. Right? When the righteous are blessed with all of the above, that produces a very na'e lahem. Okay? Those blessings, when granted to the righteous, all of these blessings are indeed a blessing. They're used for good. It's a blessing not only to the individual righteous person, but it's actually a blessing to the entire world. The, of course, implicit text here is when the wicked receive or granted some of these gifts, it is neither a blessing for them nor is it a blessing for the world. But when the righteous are granted all of the above. And then the observation that, of course, we're most interested in this context, Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya says, these seven qualities that the sages enumerated as becoming to the righteous, all were realized in Rebbe and his sons. Right? So here you have a description of Rebbe. Previous description is Torah Gedula b'makom echad. He has all the power and all of the authority and all of the intent, right? All of that in all areas. He also is blessed with every possible blessing imaginable. Some of them ones that we would have assumed, of course, wisdom, and of course, what else do we have here? Honor and beauty, riches, okay? Osher be'ayin, ken? Osher, riches, wealth. Rebbe was blessed with every possible blessing that a human being can be blessed with, and he represents the righteous. This idea that when the righteous hold all of this power, the power that beauty brings, the power that riches bring, the power that strength brings, the power that wisdom brings, the power that old age brings, all of that Rebbe has, right? And it's comely to him and comely to the world. We're beginning to get the sense that this man is as near to perfection as humanly possible. He's perfection itself, all right? And his story, therefore, is going to be, what does it look like when we have a rabbinic figure who is perfection itself, who personifies all of the perfections that human beings could even imagine? Let's project for a moment what this might look like. What will it look like when the rabbinic world, when the Jewish world, is led by a man who's near perfection? If we said before, and I'm already going to kind of move us along a little bit here, if we said before, however, that sometimes it's the strengths that are the weaknesses, I want to toss out another question, and that is, what does perfection look like? What does perfection look like when your leader is near perfect? And possibly, we're going to wonder, can perfection perhaps itself be a weakness? Can perfection be a flaw? Can there be a weakness in the very fact that you're Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad? That you have everything, beauty, riches, strength, wisdom, old, everything, children. Could that perhaps also be your greatest weakness, right? And that's what we're going to be on the lookout also for Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, third text number 3. A very striking image that the Talmud throws out at us also in its description of Rebbe. It starts with a pasuk, starts with a very familiar pasuk. Most of us will probably recognize it immediately. Vayomer Hashem la shnei goyim bevitnech. The Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb. You all remember the pasuk, right? God is speaking to Rivka. She is pregnant. She feels this struggle going on within her. She turns to God to find out what's going on. Why is she feeling these strange sensations? And she's told that you are carrying shnei goyim bevitnech. And we all know who those shnei goyim are. With hindsight, of course, we all know. Yaakov and Esau. Okay, that's important. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Ra... Excuse me, sorry, I skipped one. Read not goyim... But geim, al tikri goyim bevitnech, ela shnei geim bevitnech. I do want to actually point out that those of you who will look this up in a Tanakh or certainly in a Sefer Torah will actually discover that this is the way it's spelt in that pasuk. Shnei geim or goyim bevitnech. Now it's true the Masorah tells us to read this as goyim. If you read it any other way, if you had an aliyah in shul, or you were reading the Torah in shul, and you read it any other way, you would be corrected, because it should be read goyim. But the Midrash loves to play around with words at this kind of particular, specifically when there's an invitation to do so by the unusual spelling. And there's an invitation to read it. Actually, what God tells her is there are shnei geim bevitnech. Now, what are geim? So here I left the translation that I found in the Sonsino translation of the Talmud that translates Ge'im as lords. And there's truth to that, because Ge'im, well, where does Ge'im come from? What's the root letter? What's the root word of it? Ge'im, was it Ge'im?
Proud.
Proud, lofty, right? Elevated, right? Those who are elevated on... So yes, it does perhaps give us those who are elevated above, lordly, maybe perhaps in that sense. You have two geim bevitnech, okay? Not only two goyim, but within those goyim, you also have two geim. Now, I do want to just, however, say already, maybe some of you were thinking, that gava, geim, in rabbinic context, is not necessarily a positive quality, okay? Usually, we're a little hesitant to have a second, I'll let you speak in just a minute. When we detect gava, that's not a positive quality. We understand that to be a negative spiritual quality. And yet here we're being told, you are carrying within you two ge'im, two lords, two gentlemen, two individuals who are going to be elevated above the rest. And they're identified, Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, who are these two ge'im that she's being prophesied, that she carries the seeds of in her womb? That is Antoninus and Rebbe, who of course we identify as being, who's Antoninus?
Rome.
And Rebbe is, did you want to say?
Yeah, the word has a negative connotation in the biblical context too.
Yes.
Hashem gamul al geim.
Yes. Nachon. So it's very, it's particularly interesting, this play on goyim turning into geim, and then identifying who are these two geim that we're referring to, are you carrying in your womb? Antoninus at Rome, Esav, okay? That's of course recognized that Esav is Rome. So not only are you carrying two nations, but you are also then carrying those two lords of those two nations. almost maybe the climate, that these two nations will one day produce two individuals who will be of elevated position, and they will be Antoninus and Rebbe, the Roman emperor, and Rebbe, Antoninus, the Roman emperor, and his parallel, his twin, his contemporary, who will be none other than Rebbe. Rebbe is the Jewish emperor. He's the twin to the Roman emperor. He's our emperor. We too, okay? The rabbis are saying, the author of this midrash is saying, we too once had an emperor. Like all the nations we see around us who have these grand emperors who are majestic and overwhelming in their power and authority. We too once had an emperor. And you know who his name was? He was Rebbe. He was our emperor, all right? Now, the very image is so striking. I don't know what's speaking here. Is it envy? Is it a need for is it a need to also have, to want to be like everyone else? We too had a moment in history where we had an emperor, and that was Rebbe, right? And pretty soon we're going to see in the narratives, and anything you can do, we can do better. So our emperor is going to overshadow anybody else's emperor, including the Roman emperor himself, okay? That's going to be clear. But Rebbe is the twin brother of the Roman emperor Antoninus. Not something I think that we all expected necessarily to hear about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih. Now, he's the twin brother, but we know from Yaakov and Esav, the models, they're not identical twins. Okay, we could say maybe thank God or not thank God. They're not identical twins, but they're twinned. They were in the same womb together. The description continues, right?
Weren't they also close friends?
Yes, okay, in a minute we're going to trace a little bit that, or see as much time as we have, which isn't much. Whose table never lacked either radish, lettuce, or cucumbers, either in summer or winter, right? Both emperors, both twins, both Antoninus and Rebbe, are described in a very interesting way. They both, what kind of description is this? We could have many descriptions of what they share.
They're extremely wealthy.
They're very, extremely wealthy. We're emphasizing we too had an emperor who was as wealthy as the Roman emperor. I mean, I don't know how many of you believe this, but at least that's the narrative, that's the story. We too had an emperor, and he was as wealthy as the Roman. And not only was he as wealthy, but what else was being described here? He also lived lifestyle that was in accordance with his position. He too had a grand court. He too had a table that never lacked lettuce and radish and what was the third?
Cucumbers.
In winter or in summer, just like the Roman emperor. Now, I don't know if there's a subtext here. I don't know if as we're lavishing praise or as we're describing Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih as being the twin brother of the Roman emperor Antoninus, we're beginning to hear maybe indications, very subtle indications, of maybe a not so complimentary or a side of this position that might in later times or in some circles be looked at with less than enthusiasm or a sense that, wait a minute, where did this come from? Right? What happens when our Nasi, when our patriarch, when our top leader is living this lifestyle like the Roman emperor? Do we want our rabbinic figure to be the Roman emperor's twin? Now, as you say correctly, there are actually many legends within Talmudic literature that describe this relationship between Antoninus and Rebbe. And historians, of course, go crazy over this, right? Who is this Antoninus? How likely is it that he actually had a relationship with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih, the patriarch of Judea, right? How likely is that? I'm not going to go into the historical background, but just to give a bit of a taste of some of the interaction and how this relationship is characterized. Antoninus once said to Rebbe, source 4, it is my desire that my son Asphorus should reign instead of me and that Tiberias should be declared a colony. Were I to ask one of these things, it would be granted, while both would not be granted. Rebbe thereupon brought a man, and having made him ride on the shoulders of another, handing him a dove, okay, he puts this whole pantomime on, he puts one guy on top of the other, on the shoulders of another, gives him a dove, and he tells the one who's on the bottom, tell the guy who's on the top to release the dove, right? So he stages this whole pantomime. The emperor perceived this to mean that he was advised to ask of the Senate to appoint his son Asphorus to reign, and that subsequently he might get Asphorus to make Tiberias a free colony. Right? Now, whether you were following all of this or not for a moment, what is being described here is Rebbe is counseling Antoninus. And this continues in a long string of stories. We won't have time even to read even the small selection that I selected. Rebbe actually counsels the Roman emperor. As I said before, he not only is he equal to the Roman emperor, he's above the Roman emperor, and the Roman emperor himself recognizes it, and he consults with Rebbe on questions. But what type of questions is he perceived here, or is he depicting here? What kind of questions does he ask Rebbe? Political, how do I deal with the Senate? What do I do with my Roman senators who aren't doing... And Rebbe counsels him. He counsels him not in religious and spiritual and intellectual matters, although there are a collection of sources that have them engaged in philosophical and theological conversations as well, but he also counsels him on how to handle a Senate political. And as you get deeper and deeper into this collection of stories, and again, read them at home, we don't have time, but you'll see that the counseling that Rebbe gives is quite crafty, is quite cunning. He knows he's got political savvy, he knows how to deal with Senates, and he knows how to deal with all kinds of government challenges, governmental challenges. And at times it also gets a little distasteful, as you will continue to see. He counsels him to get rid of some of his enemies by killing them. And everything is done very subtly. He never says anything straight out, right? Everything is in pantomime. Everything is hinted at. Everything is alluded at. The subtleties, the cunningness of deep politics, maybe may I even say, dare I even say, dirty politics. Rebbe is right there, okay? And he knows how to counsel the Roman emperor in dealing with his Roman empire in the way that emperors run empires. And it's not always pretty. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is right there. And he's got all that knowledge and all that ability and all that skill, leading one to wonder, wait a minute, right? Wait a minute, what is this? What happened to my Rebbe? What happened to literally my Rebbe that I imagined him at the head of the Beit Din, right? Where is he buddying with the Roman emperor, counseling him on doing away with his political enemies? Where did that come from? And what does that do to my image of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, writer of the Mishnah, right? That too is a side of someone who's Torah and Gedulah b'makom echad. And I think at this point, I'm just going to ask it as a question. At this point, my concern is, like Yaakov and Esav, right? If we go back to the twins, one of the concerns biblically we have about Yaakov is, can Yaakov survive through his relationships both with Lavan and then later with Esav and emerge from these encounters unharmed? Spiritually unharmed, physically unharmed. There's a lot of concern for Rebbe's safety, by the way. You can see his concern for his own safety. And that's the safety measures that he takes, that he never says anything explicitly that can be quoted and can somehow get back to Rome, that he's been giving all these counsels. He's very careful about his safety. Because when you mingle with the Roman emperor, there are dangers built into that. There are spiritual dangers. There are physical dangers. He's very aware of that, as Yaakov was aware of his relationship with his twin brother. And we as readers, I think, are beginning to get a little concerned about Rebbe. Okay, what's happening to him? What happens when you occupy those places of absolute power? What happens to you?
Yeah, corrupted, absolutely.
Well, we hope not, but concern is there. The question is there. The concern is there. And the Talmud, I think, is flirting with that. Not flirting with that. Is telling us, think about this. You've got to think about it. It's part of who he was. It's part of his story, right? Okay, we need to move on. I'm sorry. I apologize to you for doing this. I've just packed so much into tonight, and I want to make sure to get as much as we possibly can. I'll stay after. I'll hear all of your observations as much as I would love to. Okay, so far we've been talking about Rebbe and his politics. Outward, right, outside. Let's look at Rebbe and his internal politics. Let's look at what Rebbe looks like in the world of the rabbis. And remember again, the sheer magnitude of this man and the powers that he holds, the gifts that he has and the power that those gifts give him, what must it have been like to be a member of his court, a member of his Beit Midrash, right? A student of his, a contemporary of his, a peer of his, a colleague of his. What's it like to live in the shadow, as it were, of this man who was so powerful. So let's read one story. We'll read a couple. Rebbe would honor Bar El Asa. I want to draw your attention. We're moved to the Yerushalmi in this text, in text number 5. Actually, the Talmud Yerushalmi, maybe not coincidentally, preserves quite a few stories of the memory of what that time period was like when Rebbe was ruling, right, the Batei Midrash and the courts of Eretz Yisrael. There are not a few stories that sort of reflect some of that memory of what that time might have been like. Rebbe would honor Bar El Asa. Word about Bar El Asa, who he is. He's mentioned in a couple of places, and from which it's apparent that Bar El Asa was a very wealthy man at the time of Rebbe. He apparently, and will be apparent from this story as well, is not a learned man. He does not come from within the rabbinic world. You notice he doesn't have a title either. He's not a rabbi, Bar El Asa. And he's not a member, he's not a learned man. He's a wealthy man. And interestingly enough, he's also Rebbe's son-in-law, which means that Rebbe married off one of his daughters, at least, to a man who is not learned, who's not a scholar, is not a rabbinic figure, but is very wealthy. Yes, okay, this is just facts. So far, I've just said facts. Rebbe would honor Bar El Asa, okay? We treat him with respect and honor. Now, we're going to be introduced to a secondary character here, Bar Kappara. Bar Kappara is a figure, he's a student of Rebbe's, as will probably be apparent pretty soon, although he's a student of an interesting type. He's a very colorful character. You'll get a sense of him a little bit in this story. There are numerous stories of Bar Kappara and Rebbe, always in association with Rebbe. But Bar Kappara is a rabbinic figure who participates in, whose Torah is included in rabbinic literature. You come across him in halachic discussions. The Talmud will quote Bar Kappara. He's there, okay? He's a member of the rabbinic world, certainly on his own merit. Bar Kappara.
He doesn't have a title here. Either.
Yes, you'll see in a minute why.
Okay.
True, he does not have a title. Bar Kappara said to him, to Bar El Asa, you know, everyone asks Rebbe questions. You never ask him anything, right? You come to class, you sit there in the corner, you've got a very honored place, right? Rebbe, right, saves a place for you. All the honor due to you as his son-in-law, all the honor due to you as maybe wealthy, but you never ask any question. You know, anybody else does. Bar El Asa says, well, what should I ask, right? And we can hear his
hesitancy.
His what?
Hesitancy.
His hesitancy, right? He doesn't even know what to ask. No, it's already a status to know what to ask, right? You're in its position. It's a reflection of
him.
He's an Enonian Eli Shol. So he says to Bar Kappara, you know, I really would like to once ask a question, but I don't know what to ask. Bar Kappara says to him, you know what? Ask him the following. I'll give you an idea. Why don't you ask him the following? Then he says something very strange. From the heavens she looks down, cooing in the corners of her home, frightening the winged ones. You see her and hide, the old rise and stand. The one who escapes says, ho, ho, and the one who is trapped is ensnared by his sin. Okay, so Bar Kappara, we'll say something about Bar Kappara in a moment, but Bar Kappara says, you know what, you don't have any questions, I'll give you a question. Next time classes, raise your hand and ask Rebbe this, okay? Now, what is this?
Right.
It's a riddle. It's clearly a riddle. It's a riddle. Look, you know what? It's either a riddle or it's absolute nonsense. Okay? It's either a riddle and it's very deep and very wise and only a very learned person will understand it. For instance, like Rebbe. Bar El Asa presumably has no idea what he's saying, right? It's coded, and Bar Kappara is planting in Bar El Asa's mouth some kind of coded riddle that Rebbe will understand, but Bar El Asa is totally oblivious of what he's saying. Or it's pure nonsense and pure gibberish in the guise of wisdom. And there are all kinds of many commentaries have tried to understand what in heaven's name is Bar Kappara putting in this man's mouth. What is this? And there are pieces of psukim here, and there are biblical references, and there are ideas, and if you think you have an idea, then the next line ruins it. It's very strange, right? Now, we're not going to solve this riddle. Let's just look at the human drama that's going to unfold. And I love to imagine, you know, Bar El Asa memorizing this long, right? And saying, okay, today's the day that I'm going to speak up in class, and he's memorized this riddle, or this poem, or whatever it is. And the moment comes, and he puts up his hand, and proudly he gets up and he says, I've got a question, and then he recites this whole thing, okay? Now, Rebbe hears him, and his response is, he turns his face and looks directly at Bar Kappara, okay? Rebbe knows his students, and he detects the signature of Bar Kappara on this piece of work, okay? He says to himself, I know exactly what's happened. This is Bar Kappara. First of all, I want to say something about Bar Kappara now. Bar Kappara is well known, first of all, for his sharp tongue and his skill with words, okay? That's apparent in many texts. Bar Kappara was a very skillful verbal person, right? He was excellent with words. And he also was a bit of a trickster and a bit of a joker. He had a sense of humor of a type, of a sort. You can like it or not like it. He was sharp and somewhat irreverent. And that comes up in a number of places. And this is a very Bar Kappara-like thing to do. To turn, I mean, this is very skillful. Because at one blow, he's humiliating both Bar Elasa, the Rebbe's son-in-law, and Rebbe himself in a very awkward position. What's Rebbe going to do? Okay, how do you respond to a... He's really manipulating everything to reveal so much and be so biting and so... Okay, Rebbe turns around and sees him. You know, it looks right directly at Bar Kappara. And he sees him grinning. Right? The original says gachich. I didn't know what to use, grinning or snickering or smirking or all the above. He sees Bar Kappara having a great time, right? This is exactly what he wanted to manipulate. Rebbe turned to him and said, I do not recognize you, old man. Okay? He says it to Bar Kappara. He says, Amar Rebbe, eini makircha zakin. Now, I had a hard time. I made a choice here in translating, but I want to explain for a minute what I did. Eini makir cha zakin is one way of translating is, I don't recognize you, zakin. Now, he's not old. Bar Kappara is not old. He's younger than Rebbe.
Right.
But zakin, of course, could be. Maybe instead of old man, I should have translated as elder. Mm-hmm. All right? Zakin is also a position, a rabbinic position to be in. He says, I don't recognize you. You're a Talmid Chacham. You're a rabbi in a Bet Midrash. This is not the way to behave. I don't recognize. I don't know who you are. I don't know you. What is this behavior, Bar Kappara? That's one way of reading it, which is very powerful. It has certainly its power, but there's another way of reading it. This is one of those examples of the power of a comma. Because if we take the comma out, and he might be saying something else. He might be saying, Eini makir cha zaken. I will not recognize you as elder. Mm-hmm. Meaning, right, and in a minute I think that's going to be supported by the next line, you are not going to become an elder, a zaken, in my Bet Midrash. And indeed, the next line is, and he knew, that he would not be appointed in his day. Appointed is a very key term here. And if we had more time, we would go into this more deeply. Appointments are one of the authorities that the Nasi, the patriarch, has. An appointment means, first of all, granting you the title of Zakin, or granting you the title of rabbi, and that's why he does not have, and it's true, Bar Kappara, to this very day, doesn't have smicha. He's not granted the title of Rabbi. He's always called Bar Kappara. He's never Rabbi Bar Kappara. And maybe this is why. Rebbe, who holds the authority of appointing people, rabbinical titles, refuses to grant him the title. And Bar Kappara knows that if you cross Rebbe's path, that's it. That's a career, that's poor, bad career move, okay? You will not be Zakin, right, forevermore. Indeed, apparently he doesn't. So appointments are titles. Is our smicha, what we would call today smicha. And Rebbe holds that power. Now that's a lot of power to hold. That's a lot of power to hold. He also holds the power to appoint positions. Right? He can appoint you chief rabbi of this, that, or the other. Neighborhood, city, country maybe. I don't know the power, the limits of his power.
Members of the court,
okay. This is a man, remember, who's Torah and Gdula b'makom echad. He holds a lot of power. What is it like to be a member of Rebbe's Bet Midrash when he holds single-handedly all that power? Now, some of us might say, well, he deserves it. Bar Kappara that deserves to be rejected from the rabbinate, okay? All right? He deserves to be rejected from the rabbinate. This is not proper behavior. The next story might, however, indicate that sometimes Rebbe might wield this power when it might potentially be less reasonable or less less convincing. Number
said,
six, yes.
You said that Bar Kappara was very smart, very clever.
Yes.
He wasn't clever enough to know that this was going to anger Rebbe and result in his not getting an appointment.
He
was mean. He was trying to embarrass the son-in-law.
Okay, so
kinds of smart also.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't smart enough not to push the envelope too far.
Well, the implication is that he didn't think that Rebbe would see his fingerprints on it.
Yeah. I don't know if he thought he would get away with it. I don't know if he can help it. There's some people that they just can't help it. That's who they are. I'm going to come back to that, hopefully, within the next 10. I'm going to come back to that comment right now, okay? I'm going to come back. But let's try and pick up as many additional points as possible. Number six. Rebbe would appoint two appointees at once. Watch his practice. How he would wield his power within the rabbinic world. Again, and I keep trying to imagine what must it have been like to be a rabbi at Rebbe's time. Rebbe would appoint two appointees at once. The ones who were worthy would stay, and the ones who were not would be removed. Right? In other words, the appointments were done in such a way that Rebbe continuously holds people's careers, okay, people in the palm of his hand. He would remove them and keep them depending on... Now, again, we could say this is great leadership. Because he doesn't just leave people to be tenured and then sit out their lives. It's a hands-on leadership. On the other hand, this is very controlling, okay? There's a lot of centralized control here that those of us that come from certain liberal, democratic, think that might be over-controlled, right? So much control in one person's hand. When he died, he said to his son, "You shall not do this, okay? I am actually instructing you not to continue in this practice, but rather you should appoint them one at a time." And then he continues and says, "Also, appoint Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina as the head." Right? He leaves another instruction. There's this individual rabbi that I want you to give him a special appointment and appoint him at the head of whatever. It doesn't say what. The Talmud Yerushalmi asks, but why didn't he appoint him himself? If he wanted this person to be appointed, why didn't he just appoint himself? Why did he instruct his son? Rabbi Yossi said because the people of Tzipori shouted in objection. Right? Rebbe lived in Tzipori. Many of you know that if you've been there. The people of Tzipori, for some reason, objected to this appointment, to which the Talmud said, what? And because the people shout, he listens? This is Rebbe, okay? He's not going to be influenced by just people shouting. Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, said, oh no, there was a different explanation why he did not appoint Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina himself. It was because he contradicted him in public. And here's the story. Rebbe was teaching a number of verses from Yechezkel, from the prophets. And the translation goes, "Yet I will leave a remnant, and then later on they shall take to the mountains, they shall be like the doves of the valley, moaning together." He quotes the verse that he says right in the original. It says, "Homiot" is the verb that's used for the doves moaning. It's a verb that actually appeared in Bar Kappara's riddle as well, and I wonder if that's coincidental. Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, who was sitting there, corrected Rebbe's pronunciation or corrected his quotation, and he says, "Homot." It's not homiot, it's homot. Now, this is a moment that could be interpreted in many ways, okay? This could be a moment, really, it's a very awkward moment when a student will correct the teacher. And it could be an indication that Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina indeed is showing a certain kind of chutzpah, right? You don't correct your teacher, you might think. I can't help but thinking sometimes, especially because of the kind of correction that it is, that it's one of these almost, this instinctive correction, right? When somebody makes a mistake, and think about it yourself, there's certain areas where somebody makes a mistake, you correct it even before you even know what you're doing. Because you know that if somebody misquotes something, right? Then and something that you know well, and you know for sure he's misquoting, you don't even realize that you're doing it, it's out of your mouth before you even recognize it. I'm kind of inclined to see Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, before he even knows it, it's out of his mouth, and he says, "It's not homiyot, it's homot." Now, everyone, by the way, always asks me, which is it? Who's right? Is Rebbe correct or is Rebbe Achavar correct? So if you look, I'll tell you. You can look it up in your head, tell yourself. Rebbe's wrong. It is homot. Okay? In other words, he is correcting, at least in our versions of Yechezkel, so far as our Masorah has it, it says homot. He is correcting him. Rebbe says, where did you learn scripture? Now here the intonation, of course, is very important. Where did you learn scripture? He's maybe impressed. Wow, you really know your scripture well, so well that you correct me. And maybe perhaps Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina also thinks he's being asked with kind of an admiration, positive. Wow, you know your scripture. Where did you learn your scripture? And he says, with Rabbi Nuna in Bavel. At which point Rebbe says to him, well, when you go back there, tell him to appoint you as elder. And he knew that he would not be appointed in his case. Okay. Now here I think it's a lot harder to justify. And we could say, listen, this person is a person who doesn't know limits, and he doesn't know when to correct your elder, or when to collect maybe, and that's why. But it's a lot harder not to see Rebbe being here, wielding the power that he has. Yes. And that the power that one has, when one has so much power, is sometimes used in ways that at least we as readers ask ourselves, what's going on here? What's happening to a man, or what's happened to a man? Or what, if you wish, I'm going to use maybe particularly harsh language, what are the darker sides of having someone who is so powerful? And what must it have been like to live under, with all of that power concentrated in one individual? Just to wrap this part up, and we'll take just quickly about 5 more minutes to try and squeeze in something else as well. A very interesting observation in source 7. This is in a Midrash to Ecclesiastes, to Kohelet, Midrash Rabbah. Rabbi Zera lives about 2 generations later. How many pious men and scholars of the Torah were worthy to be appointed, such as Yehuda, son of Chizkiah, and yet concerning them it states, neither shall be a remembrance of them in latter times. Right? He's observing that the phenomena of worthy men that were not appointed for various reasons, because they crossed Rebbe's path a little bit too much, because they pushed the borders a little bit too much. People, there are men who are worthy that are not appointed. And you know what Rabbi Zera says? In the future, however, the Holy One, blessed be He, will appoint for Himself a group of righteous men and will place them with Him in a great assembly. As it is said, then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign in Mount Zion in Jerusalem, and before His elders shall be glory. It's not written before His angels, His troops, His priests, but before His elders. Rabbi Zera is comforting himself, by saying, those men, worthy men, that were passed over for appointments, for political reasons, for personal reasons, for all kinds of reasons, some of which we maybe read ourselves, will be compensated one day. And what I'm particularly struck by is the image of the sun and the moon. Because when we studied Rabban Gamliel, I hope some of you might remember, we suggested that the moon in particular is the image of the house of Rebbe. And someone here is prophesizing, or someone here is utilizing that prophecy to say, one day the sun and the moon will be confounded, will be ashamed, and God will compensate those people who were passed over and overlooked by Rebbe and his sons. Because when politics and religion, okay, I hope I'm not getting too intense here, when politics and religion mix, it's going to have a darker side, it's going to have an underbelly, there are going to be pious people who are going to be overlooked or passed over. And Rabbi Zera is giving expression to that. He says, one day the sun and the moon will be ashamed, and God will compensate those worthy men, right? But it's part and parcel of being that authoritative figure, is that there are going to be individuals who are going to be overlooked. Okay.
This Yehuda son of Chizkiah, did he have the time of Rabbi?
Okay, so Yehuda son of Chizkiah is an interesting, I'll just comment since you raised it. First of all, there are corrections to emendations to this particular midrash. There are versions actually that say it's not Yehuda the son of Chizkiah, but Yehuda and Chizkiah, the brothers who were sons of Rabbi Chia. And a little later on, we're not going to have have time to read their story, but Yehuda and Chizkiah also crossed Rebbe's path, right? And possibly there's even a cross-reference to that. Yehuda and Chizkiah are the sons of Rabbi Chia, and they insult Rebbe. Intentionally, unintentionally, they insult him. And two never get, as you can see, all of these individuals never are granted titles, okay? Bar Kapara, Yehuda and Chizkiah. So perhaps they're intentionally, maybe it's a cross-reference to Yehuda and Chizkiah, the sons of Rabbi Chia. Okay, I want to say something about Bar Kapara back again, and Rabbi Chia as well, who won't have time to explore, but be on the lookout for Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia is another individual in Rabbi's court. He's another individual in Rabbi's life who also is a bit of a thorn in his side, like Bar Kapara, in a different way, though, in a little bit of a different way. He's not quite as young, he's not quite as mischievous, he's not quite as maybe nasty, even. But Rabbi Chia also is a companion of Rebbe that on occasion, more than one occasion, seems to hold Rebbe in check, right? And is not hesitant to put Rebbe sometimes in his place, especially when it comes to some of Rebbe's messianic aspirations, and Rebbe has messianic aspirations. Rebbe has, maybe perhaps rightly so, right? When you have everything, when you've been granted everything, it looks like it's just right around the corner, right? It's right around the corner. The role of Messiah is there to be plucked, and if anybody's going to pluck it, it's Rebbe. And he comes dangerously close, I added dangerously, okay? He comes dangerously close sometimes to being convinced that he is the King of David, right? He is a king of the house of David. And it's Rabbi Chia's role in Rebbe's life to keep checking and balancing those aspirations. So I want to say in conclusion that when you trace Rebbe, one of the things that I want to say, and I've been a little bit harsh on Rebbe, and I always feel a little guilty about painting this Rebbe picture, which shows some of maybe perhaps the darker sides of all of his power and authority. That if one thing I do want to leave you with is the idea that in spite of, in contrast with the advice that he gave the Roman emperor about, we can read about plucking the radishes and getting rid of the Roman Senate, or the Roman senators who were giving him a hard time, Rebbe does not do that in his own leadership. Rebbe actually ends up surrounding himself, apparently, with a number of individuals who are actually extremely irreverent to him and are thorns in his side. Bar Kapara remains a student. He actually remains a close student of Rebbe, so much so that in the story of Rebbe's death, which I didn't include as well, very dramatic story, it's Bar Kapara who is with Rebbe at his dying moments. It's Bar Kapara who informs the community that Rebbe has indeed passed away. So Rebbe seems to surround himself with these characters, with these personalities. Rebbe Bar Kapara is one of them, a particularly colorful one. Rabbi Chia is another, who tone him down, who keep him almost in checks and balances, maybe, as we said originally, knowing that a person of his power, a person that concentrates, so needs to not pluck out these senators and get rid of them like you would pluck out radishes and get rid of them, but particularly because of who he is and the powers that he holds, he needs these men around him, particularly the irreverent ones, the ones who have maybe even those sharp tongues and those nasty streaks. He needs them. He needs them to keep him in balance. And he does surround himself with them, indicating, I think, once again, as we said before, some kind of quality that maybe keeps Rebbe, right, in the place that we need him to be. With accessing all of that power, wielding all of that power, that enables him to produce the Mishnah and have the Mishnah, both in terms of its content and in terms of its impact on the world, be what it is. And yet keep the risks and dangers of being an emperor, right, of being that all-powerful person, keep it in balance by surrounding yourself with some of these people who can keep you sort of in check and balance. Okay, as I think also the other thing that we've continuously been doing is preparing more material than we had time to do. I hope you do go home and read some of the additional material and see how it maybe interplays with some of the ideas. There's so much more for each one of the individuals that we've been speaking about. But maybe we've given some keys, some essential themes, in the light of which you can read additional material, additional stories, additional statements by these individual rabbinic figures, and see how maybe it sheds light, new light, different light on some of the things that you see and you come across in other studies that you do. I want to thank all of you for being with me.